Okay. Today I'd like to talk about various ways of generalizing what we did in the last few days. In two ways, in fact. First of all, I want to talk about making everything cubical, and then I want to talk about going into omega dimensions instead of having some finite n. So we saw various pictures of two manifolds in boxes yesterday, and you might have been wondering, if you were at Aaron's talk last week, you might have been wondering what happened to his things, his sort of flat pairs of pants and his zipper and stuff. And the point is that this is about going cubical. Aaron had a zipper which looked something like this, with a sort of cut up here. So it was, at the top it was a circle and at the bottom it was just this, but it had this cut here. And we can't really do that in the world that we had, because we need to have identities going down the sides. Now if you wanted to put this in a box, you could sort of put it in a box like this, I didn't really draw the box, but see what I mean. So this has become, it's much more clear that this is very vertical and this is very horizontal. But now we haven't got the sides being identities anymore. So you might think to yourself, well, maybe this thing shouldn't have been a globular kind of category, but it should have been a cubical kind of category. So there's this thing called a double category. Which basically has horizontal, it has a horizontal category. So it's got morphisms going in this direction. And it's got a vertical category. And they've got the same objects. So that when you make two cells, usually when we're doing a globular type thing, we demand that the source and target of this one cell match up with the source and target of this one, and then you're allowed to have a two-cell in between. In a double category, you have some vertical arrows. Whoops, I drew them all. You have some vertical arrows, and you have some horizontal arrows, and these are a priori. These are in different categories, so you're not going to try and compose them around here. But you say that you can have a two-cell whenever you've got that kind of shape. Now, these, at first sight, they might seem a bit more complicated, but in fact, in various definitions of N category, you have to put an extra condition in to make sure that you don't have one of these. So in fact, the definition would sort of naturally want to give you one like this, and you put in an extra condition to make sure that you don't. This is something that happened in Simona's talk the other day. So this is a brief aside about this, I suppose, but that a two category is, you can define it to be an internal category in CAT. I mean, a double category. And if you decided that you wanted to take this internalization route to get ordinary two categories, you'd have to put an extra condition on to make sure that all your vertical arrows were identities. So you can demand that all vertical arrows identities, and then you get a two category back out again. And this is what happened in Simona's talk when we're looking at doing internal category objects and things and having a discreteness condition to make sure that you didn't get this cubical thing happening. Now, you can compose these two cells in this direction, and you can also compose them in this direction. And this isn't quite the same as how you compose cells in a two category. So if you try to translate backwards and forwards between a double category and a two category, it's a little bit curious, So you might say to yourself, okay, so this thing was supposed to, naturally, our cobordisms with corners look like they were going to be a double category. Now somehow, have we just ignored the zipper? It looks like we've ignored the zipper. We haven't allowed something like this to exist. However, there's a theorem about double categories, which says that under certain circumstances, you can move backwards and forwards between double categories and two categories, and you sort of don't lose any information. So, have we lost? Oh, is it? Because it looks like what we've done is we've taken a double category and we've decided to restrict to only the cells which have identities going down the sides. But under certain circumstances, that actually gives you all the two cells. I.e., if we ignore any two cells with non-trivial vertical arrows, did we lose anything? Now, this isn't quite the same way in which it's usually thought about. So usually what people think about is starting with a two category and producing a double category out of it by this thing called the quintet construction, where you make things like this, very literally. So you produce a double category whose vertical and horizontal categories are the same, and they are the category of one cells that you have in your two category. And the two cells are any two cells like this, where, of course, because it all came from a two category, you could just compose the two sides and look for a two cell going in between them like that. So that's a way of getting a double category back out of a two category. And then you can say to yourself, well, which double categories did I get like that? There were particular kinds of ones where, for a start, the horizontal and vertical categories were the same. And moreover, something else happened, and it's this thing called a connection. Connection ensures we didn't lose anything when we did our restriction. So I'm going to look at this a bit differently from how people who do double categories usually look at it, because I want to really think of, because what I got really bothered about when I was looking at air and zippers was, you know, have we lost our zipper? What happened? Have we lost our ability to do horizontal composition? So what I'm saying is, we started with a double category. We've ignored all the cells that had non-trivial vertical one cells. And I want to say, did we get everything over on the other side? So, what happened to a cell that was like this? Does it somehow appear as one that's got identities down the side? Well, it does if you have some connection cells on either side, if you can put connection cells on either side of it. That is, so what we're looking for is a cell that goes from FG to G prime F prime with identities down the side. So if we can fill this in, then we'll always be able to, we'll know that we did manage to capture all of the two cells like that by restricting to the two cells that had identities down the side. So this is what needs to be a connection cell, and that's a connection cell. So a connection cell, you need two kinds. You need one where you have identities in this corner and the same cell both pointing towards this corner. And you need one where you have identities pointing towards that corner and the same cell emanating from the top left. Now, we have got both of those in this case, because given any one cell in this direction, we can make a two cell that's got the same one coming down here by kind of rotating it upwards. It's a bit like when we did the unit and the co-unit. You just rotate it upwards and you sweep a surface out as you go. And for this one, you rotate this downwards and you sweep it downwards as you go. So at this point, I'd quite like to use a slide. Do we know how to get the screen down? In order to have this nice correspondence that you can go back and forth, so there's an equivalence, I believe, of categories. All right. Okay, now I do, in fact, have copies of this. So, so here's the thing that I started with. I said, okay, can we realize, given this two-cell that doesn't have identities coming down the sides, did it exist as a two-cell that did have identities coming down the sides? And we do it like this. So here's an example. This is the thing we want. And look, we've got this non-identity cell coming down this side, and we've got this non-identity cell coming down this side. And so what we do is we add in this connection cell here, which sort of sweeps out a surface. So I don't think I need to write anything really. So you sweep out this surface down here, and then you join it up along here, and you join it up along there. And here you've got to sweep it in the upwards direction. So then you join it up like that, and then the end result is you get this thing. So then you say, well, how am I going to compose these things? What we wanted to do was compose them sideways. And so first you have to say, well, I realized this alpha as this thing with connection cells on each side, and I realized this beta as this thing with connection cells on each side. And now you can sort of see how the connection cells are connections, because they connect up the things that you really wanted to compose that aren't facing in the right direction. So the connection cells connect with each other, and then you stick some identities in over each side. So in this example here, there's an alpha and a beta. So first you have to sweep the side of the alpha up and join that up like that. And then you have to sweep the side of the beta down and join it up like this. And then you have to add some identities in the corners. And the end result is that you have this thing. And if you look at what would have happened if you had just joined them up as double category cells, you get this thing. And then you can translate again. You say, well, is it the same thing? You say, well, you have to put in some kind of connection cell here that takes us up to there like that. And here you'd have to put in a connection cell that brings this one down like this. And so you can see that the same thing has happened. So evidently this is a rather laborious way of doing your sideways composition in a double category. So perhaps we should be doing this cubically. I mean, it seems there are several issues here. One is that it seems that you don't lose any information. It's just a bit laborious in having to see how you get everything out. But the other thing is, if you wanted to do representations of this double category in some other double category, maybe you wanted to do it in some double category that doesn't have the vertical and horizontal category being the same, in which case you're going to lose something if you regard it as a two category, because you're only going to have the representations that did have those things matching up. So those are some questions that occurred to me after Aaron's talk. Right. Are there any questions about that? So if you wanted to be a three cubicle category. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right. So doing n cubical categories is a whole question that is a big issue. I'm quite interested in looking at, so it varies with the definitions of n category. really want to be cubical, and you have to force them not to be. So I'm quite interested to... Oh, yeah, that's not a good idea, is it? I'm quite interested to see what happens if you just let them be cubical. There's also the notion of a kind of cubical multi-category, which is also interesting. Okay, enough about that. I'm just going to have a list of things that I think is interesting and isn't well understood at this point. So let's talk about... Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, this open string here corresponds to the open string at the bottom, and this bit that you're ignoring corresponds to the bit on the side. Yeah. So Aaron and Hendrik had all these open parts of their boundary that they weren't counting, and that they were just sort of ignoring.
I know, but intuitively there's already a thing that you could claim that the double category is intuitively not open from that, it's better than the back category. You don't physically, you don't want to think of a thing like that.
Well, they do. Well, because eventually you do want to be able to stick things on here.
Well, the left-hand side is physically cool. The right-hand side is...
But they do. But so if in the zipper picture, you do want to be able to stick things.
Yeah,
on here. That's what this is. All I've done is pulled it out a little bit.
In intuition that it's supposed to be time going from a closed circle to an open circle into an open interval. The right hand side is lost there.
But you've gained something else instead. So if you want to capture the intuition of a closed circle going to an open one over time, then yeah, this one is better. But if you want to encapsulate how you're going to compose them along this part, then this one is better. So perhaps in order to turn it into an algebraic situation, these ones are going to be more helpful. Whereas maybe when you're considering physics more, then this one is going to be more helpful. But the fact is that they're the same.
Yeah. Never compose along. You only compose along the open string.
No, they want to, this is something that they should be able to do that they haven't yet done yet. That you want to be able to compose along that as well.
No,
but they want to, I mean, but that's, I didn't know that no one wanted to solve it. I mean, John wants to solve it, for example. I don't know very many physicists, I don't do any physics, but John definitely says.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing. You can translate backwards and forwards between them. It's just that if you want to compose along here, so algebraically it should give you the same thing, but if you want to see how to classify the composition along these things, it's much easier if you put it like that. And I don't know why they wanted to compose along these things, presumably because something else might have evolved and might be joining up with this from somewhere else. So you want to be able to stick another one, because maybe this closed one started becoming open and then joined up with this one. I don't know. But this is what John was saying at the end of Aaron's talk, that they've left out a whole lot of the structure that you want to be there, because you want to be able to compose along these things as well. In fact, Jeff Morton has just done some construction of a weak double category of two cobordisms, I believe. All right, any more questions? Okay, let's talk about omega. So we've seen a little bit of a hint that things might actually become easier if you consider omega categories rather than n categories, because when you do n, you have to take some sort of equivalence class at the nth level. And I think often as category theorists, we think, well, equivalence classes are sort of violent and ugly, and what you really want to do is keep the information at the level above that was telling you something about those equivalence classes. And if you keep the information at all the levels above, then you never quotient, and you're in an omega category, which removes the necessity of working out some subtle way of quotienting the right things, because deciding what kind of quotient you want at the top is very subtle. So if we do this, we don't have to take some quotient ever. And if we don't have to take some quotient on the manifold side, it also means on the algebra side that we can avoid some coherence issues, maybe. There are some definitions, it's interesting, there are some definitions of N category which are iterative and therefore don't do omega very well. But there are other ones that do omega very naturally, and then the question of trying to do N is a question of saying, well, let's start with omega and then somehow quotient everything down. So it seems a bit strange to quotient this side down in order to do something over here where you've quotiented this side down as well. So you might as well take both sides being omega. Maybe it helps. Coherence on the algebra side. So the omega dimensional version of the tangle hypothesis says that there should be an omega category whose N cells are the manifolds framed. And we're still thinking about them inside boxes. So there's still a codimension, there's a fixed codimension K. So they're framed N manifolds in N plus K cubes. The only difference is that you're taking all dimensions of N here. And this should be somehow equivalent to the free K2 plenoidal omega category. This is an omega category now. Free K2 plenoidal omega category with duals an object. And it turns out that an omega category with duals turns out that an omega category with duals is forced to be an omega groupoid. So it's telling us something about the fact that when we go to omega dimensions, the whole thing has become a whole lot more tractable. Theorem and omega category with duals is an omega groupoid. You might be a bit suspicious about this because we don't know what an omega category with duals is, and we don't know what an omega groupoid is either. But it turns out that you need so little structure of an omega category with duals in order to show it's a groupoid that it doesn't even matter that we don't know what one is yet. Because in order to prove this, this is in a paper of mine from this year, I think. I guess that's last year. In order to prove it, you don't really need any complicated composition structure in the omega category. All you need, and you don't need any complicated coherence structure for the duals either. All you need, NB. All you need of the dual structure is a unit and co-unit. So you don't even need any triangle things. If you don't need any triangle things, it means that you don't need any composition longer than length 3. So we don't have to worry about the associativity in our N category. In particular, we don't have any composition of length greater than 2. We do need to know what the identities are in our structure, because the unit has to go from an identity to this composite binary composite. But we don't have to know that the unit acts as a unit at this point. All we have to know is that there is something called I, and that there is something called binary composition. So we don't even need horizontal composition or any, for the K cells, we don't need composition along 0 cells, 1 cells, 2 cells, or anything. You just need the end-to-end composition. Just need some putative identities. And binary composite. So if you know the if you know Punnell's definition of omega category, he starts with a structure that has putative identities and binary composites of all sorts. So we have even less than that. We don't have binary composites of all sorts. We only have binary composites of the final sort of K cells along K minus one cells. And the idea of this is that, well, what's an inverse in an omega category going to be? The idea is that the notion of a weak inverse gets weaker and weaker every time you add another dimension to your structure in. Notion of weak inverse. I mean, so an omega groupoid is something in which everything is weakly invertible. The notion of weakly invertible gets weaker and weaker as you add dimensions to your structure. To the point that if you have omega dimensions, it's so incredibly weak that even a mere dual will be one. So to see what I mean by it getting weaker and weaker, if you're just doing finite dimensional n categories, you can define weak invertibility by induction. Because you start by saying that for one cell, for a one cell in a one category, you start with a cell from A to B, and then a weak inverse, well, you don't really need the weak here, because it just is an inverse, is the G going backwards such that 1 equals GF and FG equals 1. So in a 2 category, I suppose I could have started at 0 and said that something was weakly invertible at 0 if it was an equality. So in a 2 category, it's the same thing, except that instead of having these, you need some 2 cells that are themselves weak inverses. Need 2 cells, eta from 1 to GF, and epsilon from FG to 1, and the two cells such that eta and epsilon are weak inverses, which we've done, because what I mean by that is that they're weak inverse 1 cells in the HOM category. And we know what weak inverse 1 cells in a 1 category are. One cell in a HOM category. So we know that this notion is like the notion of equivalence of categories, which is a bit weaker than the notion of isomorphism of categories. So for n, in an n category, you need eta and epsilon to be weakly invertible. I don't think I said that up there. I didn't mean that eta and epsilon are weak inverses for each other. I meant that they were weakly invertible. Okay, good. Everyone understood. Eta and epsilon to be weakly invertible as one cells in the HOM n minus 1 category, which we know about by induction. This is all very well, but if you try and do omega, you can't do omega like that, because you don't. Your HOM thing is a HOM omega category, so you don't get anywhere by induction. So intuitively, you want to say, well, just keep going forever. And that's basically what you say, it's just you can't quite say it like that. So one thing you can do, and this is what Buchanan does when he's thinking about weak omega groupoids in his definition. What you say is that you try taking the co-skeleton, the N co-skeleton of your omega category for every N, and you demand that your cell is weakly invertible in the N category, which is the N co-skeleton at every N. So what's the N co-skeleton? The N co-skeleton is where you truncate yourself after dimension N, so you're only going to have N dimensions, and then you put an equivalence relation on your N cells, declaring them to be equal if there used to be any N plus 1 cell going in between them whatsoever. What? so you ignore dimensions greater than N and put an equivalence relation on N cells saying F is, let's call it something else, alpha is equivalent to beta if there exists an N plus 1 cell, or there used to exist an N plus 1 cell theta from alpha to beta, or indeed in the other direction. And then to be weakly invertible in an omega category, you have to be weakly invertible in every N co-skeleton. So what that means is that you've got something in between you at N plus 1, and you've also got something in between you at N plus 2, and you've also got something in between you at N plus 3, and so on. So a weakly invertible in an omega category, if and only if you're weakly invertible in every N co-skeleton. Another way of saying this, that's not what I did. Another way of saying this is to say, well, I'm going to be weakly invertible if there's some set of cells of every dimension which kind of witness the fact that I am weakly invertible. Demand. So it's like simultaneously demanding e to the epsilons at every dimension all the way up. Demand a set of witnesses to the invertibility. Can't spell invertibility. So this is going to be called W, and it has to satisfy these closure conditions, which is, so if you're going to do F, we want F to be weakly invertible. So first of all, F has to be in there. You should think of W as being some set of weakly invertible cells, and you want to have enough of them to show that F is one. So F needs to be in there, and for all alpha in there, you've got to have, so if alpha goes from A to B, you've got to have an alpha star going from B to A in there, and a unit and co-unit from 1 to alpha star alpha eta from alpha alpha star to 1, and those both have to be in there as well. So since they're in there, this condition means that they will also have to have some cells going back again and some things exhibiting them as weakly invertible, and those cells will also have to be in there, so there also have to be cells exhibiting them as weakly invertible. So it's now very easy to show that as long as you've got these duals, or not even full duals, but these pre-dual-like structures, then you'll have this set of witnesses, because you can just put your entire N category, your entire omega category into W, and it will satisfy this, because everything has a dual. If you're an omega category of duals, everything has a dual, therefore everything has this structure. So that's fine. If C is an omega category with all, so I say pre-dual because it's not really a dual what I've got, it's something really pathetic, which should be the beginning of the definition of dual. With all pre-duals, we can put all morphisms. There's some boring consideration about zero cells. Do we care about our zero cells? Well, we don't really care about our zero cells when we're doing the groupoid thing. So we can put all cells, maybe, of dimension greater than or equal to 1 in W, and that shows us that everything is weakly invertible. All cells . So this, I like really thinking of this as the fact that if you procrastinate forever, then you never have to deal with any of your problems. Why not?
This definition is kind of silly. It's like
Well, if you can write down something precise about why you think it's wrong, that would be interesting. So I'm going to show you some interesting things that might start happening given this fact. I mean, there are other things you can think about it, like that in some definitions, the internal equivalences, these are the same as the weak invertibility, the weak invertibles. The internal equivalences have to be given as an extra piece of structure. And if they're given as an extra piece of structure, then you can't become one just by having lots of things going backwards and forwards, because you're either born one or you're not born one. It's not something that you can attain. But that's a whole different question. It's an interesting question. So there is a question about whether the free thing with duals ought to be the same as the free groupoid. And if you believe that to be a weakly invertible, you have to be born like that, then the free things are going to be different, because freely you need to add all your duals if you're a free thing with duals, but you don't have to christen them invertible. Whereas if you're making a free omega groupoid, you have to make everything invertible, so you have to christen everything invertible, and then you're going to get two things which are sort of going to be bijective on cells or something, but they won't match, their equivalences won't match up. Yeah. Well, it depends what your point of view is. So Bruce thinks they shouldn't be, and Carlos Simpson also thinks they shouldn't be. They should not be equivalent. John Byers thinks that they should be, I think. And I mean, it just depends. So it's also something to do with, there are different approaches to everything, and in some approaches things become the same and some they don't. And it's to do with the algebraic, non-algebraic thing, and about whether you think something should be a structure or a property. And in various definitions of N category, different parts become structures when in other ones they were properties. So for example, in a Byers-Zolan type approach, composition is a property, not a piece of structure that you put on top. And there are questions about whether this gives you something that's actually different. Does it give you something that's actually different? Can you make a free thing if it's only a structure and not a property? There are all these things that we don't understand. Did I just write on that? No. Yep.
So by a dual and an omega category, you just gain kind of
triangular shape with a full cell inside.
Yeah.
And the full cell should be.
So that's why it's a pre-dual. I've ignored all the further coherence questions. All you need is that triangle in order to get yourself to be weakly invertible in this sense. So you should at least... So if you are a dual, you should at least be able to do that. You can't fill... No, because it has to have a 1 at the end. You have to fill the triangle that's got an F and a thing going backwards and an identity at the end. In a quasi-category, you can't necessarily fill it with a 1. F, something, and 1 at the bottom. Yeah? Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know if this is the same question you're asking me, but I was thinking about the fact that if you do the homotopy hypothesis and only use n dimensions, then you're not going to expect to get an equivalence, but you might expect to get some kind of a weak adjunction. And as you get higher and higher and higher, you get more weakness of adjunction. And then finally, if you do the homotopy hypothesis and include the full omega categories, so you take the omega category of all n types and you take the omega category of omega categories or omega groupoids, then maybe you expect to get an omega equivalence between them, and it's something somehow similar that if you truncated you only got an adjunction, but if you went all the way to omega you were expecting to get an equivalence. It's not exactly the same situation. Is that what you're asking? Okay. Right. So, the co-skeleton definition that we had here shows us that if you start with an omega category, you can quotient it down to an n category by taking the n co-skeleton. And if you started with something that was an omega groupoid and you quotiented it down like that, you'd get an n groupoid. But it also shows that if you started with an omega category with all duals and you took its co-skeleton, you'd expect to get an n groupoid and not just an n category with duals. So you might think to yourself, what's going on? And it's quite interesting, the difference between taking the co-skeleton and doing some other kind of quotient. What's happened to us in our case is that we didn't take cobordism classes of n cobordisms. We only took some kind of weird isotopy classes of them. If we had taken the cobordism classes, that would have been like taking the co-skeleton, and then we would have got an N groupoid back out again. This is related to something Bruce was saying the other day about whether those things at the top are going to be inverses or not. If we took cobordism classes, everything would end up invertible. But that's not what we wanted to do. So the case of cobordisms is slightly curious because we have another notion of morphism in between our N cells, other than the N plus 1 cells of the omega category. And we can quotient using that notion. So we have this notion of isotopy. It's also related to what Peter was saying in his talk, where if you have cobordisms, but you've ignored some structure because there are maps between them that aren't cobordisms. There you can take smooth maps between manifolds, and that's nothing to do with taking cobordisms between them. So there are two different kinds of morphism you can take. Because we have this extra kind of morphism, we can use that to quotient down and get something that wasn't as violent as the co-skeleton. And what we'll see now is the sort of how these things compare and how the more violent one becomes less violent as you include more and more dimensions, and then maybe they coincide when you get to omega. So co-skeleton, what? N co-skeleton is like taking cobordism classes of N cobordisms of N manifolds. Rather than our careful isotopy classes. well, maybe we will take a break. Do we want a break? I think Nick wants a break. Well, I'm going to go and get some more water. This can turn into a break if anyone wants it to.
Maybe it had heated up at that stage because he checked it with his thermostat.
Oh, I see.
76, 77.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay today, or?
I haven't been in there much.
Yeah, because
today.
He checked it like, and it was all at 76, 77.
Oh, I see.
You know, and it was okay.
Okay, it does tend to get much colder in the evenings when I'm here after.
Yeah. But at that stage, as I said, like when he checked all over. It was like 77, you know?
Okay.
So, but if it ever happens, like, and I'm here, just let me know and I'll go up and then I can call
them. Okay.
Like I said,
okay.
Do anything because
it's definitely worse in the evenings. Is it possible to do anything about because then there's no one here for me to ask about it when it's.
Right, yeah. I can tell them back again.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It's the wrong kind of horn.
Yeah. You don't know even if there's something inside.
You don't even know if there's something going back.
You don't know even if there's something back. And even if I have it, there's not even anything.
But if, for example, in Street's definition, that would need a filler. If this F was thin, then it would be the kind of horn that would require a filler, because this one's thin as well. So.
Thin filler, eh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to talk to Nicole about that.
You see, I gave you a lead-in.
Yeah. So you can try to prove this thing that I wrote down in the
right.
paper while I talk to Nicole.
All right.
Maybe it works. Maybe it
doesn't. All right. This one, that's because it's me making notes to myself.
Oh,
it's a zipper condition.
Like going back up inside itself or something?
Yeah, yeah. So that's the, this is the flat pair of pants.
Okay.
I don't understand the zipper condition in these circumstances yet. It's a bit strange. It's something like this.
Who knows? Using the door of the. Okay, so let's consider the stable case of the tangle hypothesis now. So we did, the usual tangle hypothesis has n things in n plus k, n manifolds in n plus k cubes, and it has k supremenoidal n categories. And both of these are supposed to stabilize when k is greater than or equal to n. So in that case, we have a stable version of the tangle hypothesis. So this is when k is greater than or equal to n plus 2. On the one hand, you have an n category whose n cells are these careful isotropy classes. Or framed n manifolds with corners. And this is supposed to be equivalent to, it was K2 plumenoidal n categories, but now we've gone into the stable case, so we're a stable n category. Free stable n category with duals on one object. So, let's see, what shall I do? I'm going to draw a diagram that I can leave up. So if we write n cob k for the n category of n manifolds in n plus k dimensions, then we've got n cob k, which according to the tangle hypothesis is supposed to be equivalent to, so this is n manifolds with corners, blah blah blah, in n plus k cubes. Okay. That's supposed to be equivalent to the free K2 plumenoidal N category, which I'm going to write as F N comma K, which is the free K2 plumenoidal N category with duals on one object, blah blah blah. And one thing we've done is we've gone to the stable case. So if we make k large enough, we get to the stable case, which is going to be n cob, and I'm going to put an omega here to indicate that we're sort of in as many dimensions as we want now. And so what this version of the tangle hypothesis is saying, that this is supposed to be equivalent to the free free stable n category with duals on one object. So I'm going to put an omega here to show that k has sort of, we've got as many monoidal structures as we possibly can on here. So this is making k large like this. The other thing we've done is that we've considered the omega dimensional case instead of the n dimensional case. So instead of making k large, we could have made n large, and we get, I'm going to call it omega cob, which is to be omega cob k. So it's cobordism. There's still a codimension of k here, but we've taken the entire omega category of them. And so the omega version of this tangle hypothesis says that that's supposed to be free K2 plumenoidal omega category with duals on one object, which I'll write as F omega to show it's an omega category, and K to show that it's still K2 plumenoidal. So this says don't terminate, and down here we're also saying don't terminate but take the full omega category. So now you might ask yourself whether you can fill in this corner of the cube as well. So can you go to what would be here, would be a full omega category of n manifolds where you'd made k as large as you wanted as well. So we're just now the full omega category of n coborders of n manifolds. So this is the full, so this is just n manifolds, abstract n manifolds with corners of at all dimensions. And so what we've done down here is we've taken these were abstract N manifolds as well, but we did take isotropy classes at the top. So what we're doing is we're not terminating down here. So the whole move from this back face of the cube to this front face consists of not terminating. And so then there's a question of what can we put here? Is there something like F omega omega, which should be something like the free stable omega category with duals on one object? In which case, this version of the tangle hypothesis might say that the free stable omega category with duals on one object is this omega category of N manifolds, abstract N manifolds at all dimensions. So this is a don't terminate. So what on earth is here? Because you can't just say make K greater than or equal to N plus 2 anymore. Sorry, I probably could have just put it on a moving board because I'm probably not going to use enough boards to wipe them off, but oh well. You can't just say make K large enough because our N has turned into omega, so what does it mean to make K large enough at this point? So this is not a well-defined thing. You probably have to take some kind of limit or something. So there's a question. And then maybe this is the free stable omega category with duals, omega category, because if it's an omega category with duals, then it's an omega groupoid. So maybe this is a free stable omega groupoid on one object. And maybe it's not if we want our equivalences to be structure. But then we're saying something about the free stable omega groupoid on one object. So you write something. Yeah. What a stable omega category. So to do the omega stable version, we need to know what that is. We can't just say let K greater than or equal to N plus 2. So we might have to do some kind of limiting thing. Which I started to see, I feel like it's a bit like how you take infinite loop spaces. Except that there's something funny about that, because taking loop spaces is adjoint to suspension. And our stable thing is supposed to be like suspension. So I'm not quite sure why that feels like it's like taking infinite loop spaces. So if anyone knows why I feel like it's like that, then tell me. Right. Are there any questions or probably comments about that? This one needs to lend some of its resistance to this one. So now if we think about taking the N co-skeleton instead of taking these cobordism classes, I said the wrong thing. Now if we start thinking about taking the N co-skeleton, i.e. cobordism classes, instead of these careful isotropy classes, then it might start reminding us of the Tom Pontryagin theorem. think about cobordism classes. So what this says is that if you take cobordism classes of n manifolds of framed n manifolds. So we're not doing corners at this point. It doesn't talk about corners, so we're only looking at that dimension by itself. So this is a group. Sorry? No. They're stably framed, Nick tells me. So when you think about the Tom Pondragon theorem, you start thinking about manifolds embedded in space with a framing like that, and you get a sort of non-stable case, and then you take it to the stable case to get the thing on abstract manifolds. And this is isomorphic to the nth homotopy group of the infinite loop space of S infinity. So this is isomorphic to the nth homotopy group of loop infinity of S infinity. So now you think to yourself, well, there are two things we can do, right? Instead of thinking about just the nth homotopy group, we could try thinking about the N groupoid, the fundamental N groupoid instead, and take account of not only all dimensions all at once going up to there, but also not just the loop in the space, but just paths between them as well. So that over here, instead of having a group, we're going to get an N groupoid. And what that corresponds to maybe over here is taking the full N category of N manifolds with corners. So you're allowing yourself to have boundary all the way up. When you take a homotopy group, it's sort of like not allowing yourself to have any boundary because you only consider loops that go right back to themselves. So what we could do here is we could generalize to take the fundamental N groupoid instead of loop infinity of S infinity. And over here, that would perhaps correspond to, I mean, intuitively, it corresponds to taking N manifolds with corners of N framed N manifolds with corners as an N category, which this is like taking the N co-skeleton of what we just did. So it's not just an N category, but it's actually turned into an N groupoid because of the cobordism classes thing. So this is N groupoids. Question. And then you could say, well, how about we don't just stop at N, but we do the full fundamental omega groupoid? So now we could say don't terminate here, and we could take the fundamental omega groupoid of that. And if we don't terminate over here, what we expect to get is the omega category of framed cobordisms with corners, which we're expecting just to be an omega category with duals, right? But if we believe that an omega category with duals is in fact an omega groupoid, then it makes sense to wonder if these two things are the same as well. And omega category with duals. So here we've got an omega through a dual, and here we've got an omega groupoid that we sort of arrived at by generalizing in the same way, at least intuitively. And so we can wonder if those two things are the same, which we wouldn't be able to do if this omega category with duals wasn't an omega groupoid at all. It's just occurred to me that if an omega category with duals isn't an omega groupoid, then the fundamental omega groupoid probably isn't an omega groupoid either. Okay. Now which board shall I write on? So what this shows us, I want to do another sort of schematic diagram on this board. So what this shows us is, I think it's quite an interesting comparison between the difference between doing a co-skeleton thing and quotienting a lot and doing this other kind of isotopy thing that we had. So we started, supposing we did the whole thing backwards, what we've been doing is gradually building up our dimensions going to omega. But let's pretend for a second that we understand everything that there is to understand and that we just know what all these omega categories are. So we've got this omega category, which is n-cob, as an omega category, which has all the coordinates with corners at all dimensions. And then there are two things we can do. We can take its co-skeleton, its n co-skeleton, and we get co-bordism classes of n manifolds. So what is it that we did over here in order to get our n category with duals? So if you come out into the algebra world, it's not clear, at least to me, what it is that we did algebraically, because we did something very manifoldy in order to get our n category. So we did something here, and we got isotopy classes of n manifolds. So this is in n groupoids, and this is in, maybe I should put it over here, in n categories. And the other side of my diagram. Apparently I've got a side of a diagram over here, which says that over here, oh that's right, so we could have taken this over here, and we got the fundamental n groupoid of looped infinity of F infinity, maybe, which is like the Tom Pondragon theorem. And over here, we got algebraically the free stable n category with duals on one object. And these both came from this thing here, which we thought might be the free stable omega category with duals, which we also thought might be the free stable omega groupoid. So we think that was co-skeleton. And this is the place where we don't know what that was. And that somehow there's this diagram as well. So now that we've got into the realm of all sorts of things we don't understand at all, I feel that that's all I want to say. Are there any questions or comments? What's the relationship of this theory with physics? Well, the physicists like studying topological quantum field theory. That's about all I can say about it. They want to model space-time. They think that space-time ought to look like manifolds
but they don't really know what it looks like. There are things called strings which can be open and closed, and when they move through space, they sweep out surfaces that look like manifolds with corners. So they're not necessarily interested in the really high dimensional ones, but at some point it gets so much harder doing the dimensions they want that you might as well do the general dimension at the same time, perhaps. They're interested in getting invariance of these spaces because you want to assign probabilities to various things happening, and so what they want is some kind of way of classifying these spaces so that you can decide what you want them to be invariant under, and you can make some very violent ways of classifying them where you identify lots of things and call them the same, so your invariant doesn't detect very many of the differences between them. But if you want to detect more subtle differences between them, this is all a question of saying which differences between them did you want to detect, and therefore what do you think you want to be invariant under. And so when you take an algebraic description of it, saying it's the free something something something, what you're saying is that those are the structures that you wanted to respect when you're thinking about your invariant, so that when you take your functor that respects those structures going to somewhere that gives you this invariant over here, you want your functor to respect those pieces of structure, which here might be some sort of stable n category with duals, and it's saying that those are the things you want your invariant to detect. That's about all I can say about that.